Okay. Good afternoon, and thank you for inviting me. And I will have to ask your apologies, or in other words, to pardon my French. But I think that it will be easier to follow my ideas if I phrase them in English. So, the Book of Kings, the second Book of Kings, tells an interesting story about taboo being transgressed. This is the story about the rise and fall of Athaliah, an Israelite princess who took the throne of Judah in Jerusalem. According to 2 Kings 11, after her son, Ahaziah, king of Judah, died in battle, she murdered all the potential heirs to the throne of David and became the king of Judah. One baby, Jehoash, the son of Ahaziah, and actually her own grandchild, was saved from the massacre and hidden in the temple of Yahweh in Jerusalem. Finally, after 6 years, Jehoiada, the priest, assembled the temple and the palace guards and organized some coup against the reign of Athaliah. Then, he crowned Jehoash as the new king of Judah and executed Athaliah. The depiction of Athaliah, as well as the chain of events presented in Kings, raises some crucial questions. How could a female become the king of Judah? Why did she have to murder her own descendants? Was it possible to hide a baby for 6 years in the temple without the reigning queen to know about it? And could she really have ruled Jerusalem alone, without any support, even for a few years? The aim of this presentation is to reconstruct the historical circumstances for the rise and fall of Athaliah. To do so, I shall begin with a survey of the archaeological record of Israel and Judah in the 10th and 9th centuries, as I believe that the archaeological record may shed some new light on the historical circumstances for the rise and fall of Athaliah. Archaeological research in Judah has shown that many aspects of the political, economic, and sociological organization of southern Canaan during the 11th, 10th, and 9th centuries BC continued to function as they had in the Late Bronze Age. Namely, political and territorial affiliation was disseminated among city-states, which were the basic political and economic units. During this period, Jerusalem was no more than a hill country stronghold. The meager archaeological finds attributed to the 11th, 10th, and 9th century Jerusalem were restricted to the summit of the southeastern ridge of the city, and its hinterland was sparsely inhabited. Even according to biblical maximalist view, only two architectural features in Jerusalem can be attributed to the 10th century, the so-called stepstone structure and the large stone structure. However, their date, as well as their function, is hotly debated among scholars. This debate is not of our concern here. It is enough to stress that at the very minimum, some of these architectural elements were constructed as early as the 10th and 9th centuries, thus demonstrating the different level of urbanization between the city and its rural surroundings. Yet, given the settlement pattern to its west, which I'll discuss soon, and to its south, it seems that Jerusalem, in the early Iron Age, remained, as it was in the Bronze Age, a local city-state that controlled the hill country of Judah. To the west of Jerusalem lay the fertile Judahite lowlands, in which Ekron was the most important, here is Ekron, and in fact, the only urban center throughout the 11th century. By the 10th century, it was violently destroyed, while to its south, the city of Gat continued to grow, becoming an important urban center in the middle of the 10th century. Throughout most of the 9th century, Gat, with its rich material culture and epigraphic finds, was the main urban center of the Judahite lowlands. This lasted until its brutal destruction in the second half of the 9th century, probably by Hazael, king of Damascus. Given this settlement pattern, it seems that the Judahite lowlands were under the sovereignty of Philistine cities, first Ekron and then Gat, throughout the 11th and the 10th and most of the 9th century BC. Only in the second half of the 9th century, with the destruction of Gat, could the kings of Jerusalem expand their sovereignty to the lowlands? Judahite fortified cities and administrative centers like Lachish and Beth Shemesh were erected in the lowlands only in the second half of the 9th century, demonstrating the earliest indication for the expansion of the Jerusalem polity and mark its borders. Therefore, it should be concluded that only by the second half of the 9th century did Judah rise as a territorial kingdom with a centralized regime in Jerusalem. It is during this period that the first indication of an administration system and even the adoption of alphabetic script appeared in the form of bullae used to seal documents that were unearthed in the city of David. Concurrently, luxury items show the first indications of trade with the Western coasts and, to some extent, social stratification in Judah. This differed from the situation in northern Canaan. The territorial kingdom of Israel had already been formed in the 10th century. The Israelite settlement from the northern hill country, with its political centers in Shechem, here, and later in Samaria, had expanded to the northern valleys, and by the mid-10th century, Israelite towns were founded in the Jezreel Valley and in the Jordan Valley. This not only allowed the use of fertile valleys lands for agricultural cultivation, but also, and more importantly, it allowed control over the main Levantine trade routes, which enabled the new territorial kingdom of Israel to accumulate economic surplus and to become a major polity in the region. For this reason, Israel is mentioned in historical sources as early as the first half of the 9th century BC. Assyrian, Aramaic, and Moabite inscriptions indicate that the consolidation of the Kingdom of Israel under the rule of the Omrites dynasty, who were powerful kings that ruled over vast territories in the southern Levant. They allied themselves with powerful Aramean kingdoms and with the rich Phoenician city-states. Judah, on the other hand, is almost entirely absent from contemporaneous historical sources. But that is hardly surprising considering the archaeological record discussed here. In the late 10th and throughout most of the 9th century, Jerusalem was still a hill country local polity, while Israel was already a territorial kingdom controlling important trade routes and exploiting heterogenic population and economic opportunities. Judahite kings were in the shadows of the strong, influential political power of Israel and its royal dynasty, the Omrites. Thus, it comes as no surprise that all the biblical reference and even some historical sources concerning the Judahite kings of the first half of the 9th century present them as inferior to their Israeli counterparts, and they had to shape their policy vis-a-vis their northern neighbors. By the way, this is not to say that every verse here is historically reliable, but I think that they are coherent with the archaeological and the historical record that we have, and they preserve the historical memory of Judahite kings being inferior to the Israelite kings in the early 9th century. This is the context to discuss who was Ataliah. Ataliah was an Omrite princess, probably the daughter of Omri himself. And she was given to a Judahite prince, Jehoram, as a wife. Diplomatic marriage were a common element of ancient Near Eastern diplomacy. In few known cases, powerful kings sent their daughters to royal courts of their vassals or to kings inferior to themselves, expecting them to become the chief wives of the palace and to bear the royal heir. In this way, the powerful king could secure the loyalty of the royal houses, especially when the heir was descendant of both. It seems that this is also the reasoning behind the marriage of Jehoram and Ataliah. She had won the status of a chief wife as her son, Ahaziah, inherited the throne of Judah after his father's death. The presence of an Omrite princess in the court of Jerusalem and the fact that Ahaziah and the Omrites were relatives secured the loyalty of Davidic kings to Israel and actually established Omrite hegemony over Judah. Thus, The Omrites were able to dictate the foreign policy of Judahite kings according to their own needs and interests, as is shown by biblical and extra-biblical sources. Excuse me for a minute. Now it is time to discuss the historical circumstances for the rise of Ataliah. The historical circumstances that enabled the rise of Ataliah to the throne of Judah are rooted in the events of the year 841. It is widely known that by the mid-9th century BCE, Shalmaneser III, king of Assyria, had already subjugated Aramean and Luwian kingdoms of North Syria and was aiming his annual campaigns against the central and southern Syrian kingdoms. A coalition of 12 kingdoms and Phoenician city-states led by the king of Damascus, the king of Hamath, and the Omrite king Ahab of Israel was formed in order to face the advancing Assyrian army. The coalition forces contended with Shalmaneser four times until 845 BC, blocking his advance. But by 841 BC, the Syro-Canaanite alliance came to an end. Israel, Hamath, and Phoenician city-states were probably weakened by the ongoing wars with the Assyrian army and chose to pay tribute and to be subjugated to Shalmaneser III. Hazael, who usurped the throne of Damascus, was left to face the Assyrian on his own. On the eve of the Assyrian campaign to Damascus in 841 BC, Joram, the last Omrite king of Israel, and Hazael, king of Damascus, even fought each other in Ramot Gilead of Transjordan. As both the Aramaic inscription from Dan and biblical historiography demonstrate, Ahaziah, king of Judah, and Ataliah's son joined Joram in his hopeless fight against Damascus. Joram and Ahaziah died in battle, and Jehu, the son of Nimshi, a senior member in the armed forces of Joram, usurped the throne of Samaria in a bloody coup, killing all the royal members of the Omrite dynasty. At the same time, Jehu paid tribute to Shalmaneser and was subjugated to him. Consequently, Shalmaneser probably recognized his kingship over Israel, naming him the son of Omri. A view from the late 40s and the early 30s of the 9th century shows that Jehu made a wise political choice. Already in 841, Damascus and Israel were enemies, and apparently, Israel could not confront Hazael of Damascus successfully. By becoming an Assyrian vassal in the first decade of his rule, the period in which it was necessary for Jehu to secure the throne after his bloody coup, Jehu was able to gain Assyrian protection. Shalmaneser campaigned against Hazael of Damascus again in 838 and 837, causing severe destructions. His later campaigns in North Syria indicate that though he could not subjugate Damascus, his hegemony over Syria was secured. Thus, in the 30s of the 9th century, with Hazael under Assyrian siege, Jehu was left as one of the most powerful rulers of the southern Levant. Only by the end of the 30s, as a result of a revolt in Assyria, Shalmaneser had to retreat from the Syro-Palestinian states, consequently allowing for the rise of Aramean hegemony. Hazael attacked Jehu and destroyed the royal cities built by the Omrites in the northern valley, as is also shown in the archaeological record, diminishing the power and influence of Israel. In addition, probably trying to assert his hegemony in the southern Levant, Hazael attacked and destroyed the powerful and rich city of Gat, which ruled the Judahite lowlands throughout most of the 9th century BC. He then went on to collect the tribute of King Jehoash of Judah. This is the historical context for the rise of Judah as a territorial kingdom in the late 9th century BCE. But it is also the historical background for the reign of Ataliah and the usurpation of Joash. The events of 841 BC, the death of Ahaziah, king of Judah, in battle against Damascus, together with the demise of the Omrites, had a major effect in Judah as well. The last Omrite survivor, Ataliah, seized the throne of Jerusalem. After for almost half a century, the Davidic kings were under the hegemony of the royal house of Samaria. The events of 841 BC brought about a change in this status. Jehu usurped the throne of the Omrites in Samaria and killed all their descendants. Athalia, the last Omrite survivor, became the queen of Judah. Thus, for the first time in almost half a century, the king of Judah and the kings of Samaria were rivals. In this context, I shall examine now the rise and fall of Athalia in Judah, and in order to understand her position, analogy with other ancient Near Eastern courts is needed. The chief royal wife in ancient Near Eastern courts was chosen to be the mother of the king's heir. Hence, she represented the dynastic continuity and was to some extent involved in the royal cult and administration of the palace. Nevertheless, her status in the cult and in the palace was determined according to her relationship with the reigning king, as he had the power to choose the mother of his heirs and to replace her. Only in rare cases did royal female, whether it was the wife or the mother of a reigning king, practice actual sovereignty in the kingdom. The cases of Shiptu, the wife of Zimrilim, king of Mari, and Puduhepa, wife of Hattushili, king of the Hittite Empire, are widely known. Both women were involved in royal administration, foreign affairs, and diplomacy, and they even represented the king in his absence. Sammuamat and Akhiazakutu, in the New Assyrian Empire, were queen mothers who gained a special place in the royal cult and administration. All these women had a special relationship with the reigning king who trusted them and bestowed upon them some of his authority. Nevertheless, considering this phenomenon in the context of its wide chronological and geographical distribution, it seems that only in rare cases did a royal female take an active role in kingship. Accordingly, it may be assumed that Athalia gained an important status in Jerusalem as she was designated to be the chief wife of the Davidic king Jehoram and thus to bear his royal heir. Considering her origin from the strong dynasty, together with the fact that her marriage realized political alliance and established the Omrite hegemony over Judah, it may be assumed that Athalia had a special political status in Jerusalem already as the chief wife of Jehoram. If so, her status was only strengthened when her son Ahaziah ascended the throne. Yet, queenship, namely, a woman acting as a solitary sovereign of a kingdom, is an even rarer phenomenon in the ancient Near East, and it is known only in form of regency. In a few cases known from Egyptian dynasties, queen regents rule Egypt when a king died while his heir was underage or when he did not have an heir at all. The most famous case is that of Hatshepsut. She was a regent of the royal heir, Thutmose III, who was still young when his father died. In Thutmose III's 7 years, she took on attributes of male kingship, claiming the rule of Egypt for herself for 15 more years. However, she never undermined the status of the young king and kept the presentation of a rule as co-regency. Accordingly, it may be concluded that women who appropriate throne were always linked to a male heir and represented the continuity of the reigning dynasty. Thus, the presentation of Athalia in 2 Kings 11 as a foreign queen who usurped the throne of the Davidic kings and acted alone with no support is highly unlikely. Athalia could not have acted alone, and in order to reign, she had to have had at least some support from the nobility and the palace administration. King Ahaziah died at the age of 22 or 23, which means that his eldest heir could not have been more than 10 or 12 years of age. Therefore, Athalia could have been considered a legitimate queen representing the royal line and probably even acting as a regent for a young heir. Against this background, it is highly unlikely that she murdered all the royal heirs, all the royal descendants to the throne of David on her way to the throne. As far as we know, no royal woman in the ancient Near East could have practiced sovereignty without dynastic legitimacy from a royal male. Moreover, Athalia's entire being was defined by relations to royal dynasties. After Jehu massacred her Omrite family members in the north, it was unreasonable to cut the only royal link she was left with. The claim that Athaliah killed all the royal heirs of the house of David would mean denying her own legitimacy. Calling her usurper meant justifying the second usurpation when she was brutally replaced by Yehoash. If so, Athaliah was not a total foreigner or a bloody usurper. Why was she driven out and murdered? What were the reasons for that? Athaliah and her supporters in Jerusalem were actually positing resistance to Yehu, as it was the first time in decades that the house of David did not comply with the political interest of the king of Israel. This was probably the reason for the revolt that drove her from the throne, as executing her meant compliance with Yehu's policy against the Omrites in Israel. As mentioned above, during the first decade of his reign, Yehu was a powerful king in the southern Levant, as his most dangerous enemy, Hazael of Damascus, suffered ongoing Assyrian invasions. If the reign of Athaliah was in fact an act of resistance against Yehu, it would have left Judah isolated in the new post-Omrite political order. It may be assumed that the murder of Athaliah was motivated by fear of Yehu and by the political tendency of the Judahite kings to be loyal to the kings of Israel. The revolt against Athaliah and the crowning of Yehoash were actually declaration of fidelity towards Yehu. This historical reconstruction also clarifies the reason behind the presentation of Athaliah as a foreign Omrite ruler and Yehoash as the legitimate royal heir of the house of David. The conspirators claim that they executed an Omrite queen reveals them as the executors of Yehu's policy against the Omrites. At the same time, the claim that Yehoash was a true legitimate heir to the house of David asserted that there was no change in Judah. While the royal house of Samaria was replaced, that of Jerusalem demonstrated continuity and stability. Continuity and stability also meant loyalty to the kings of Israel. So now it's time for some conclusions. The Athaliah and Yehoash affair was the opening verse to the period in which Judah expanded its territory. The expansion of Judah probably occurred during the reign of Yehoash and possibly also during the reign of his son, Amatziah. Yehoash's subjugation to Hazael becomes clear against this background. Hazael, whose inscription portrays Yehoash's father, Ahaziah, as an ally of the Israelite king, must have noticed the change of policy during his son's reign. Yehoash did not join Yehu's military struggle against Hazael. It was under Aramean hegemony that Judah gained territorial benefits. These benefits may well have been Yehoash's reward for his loyalty to Damascus. Accordingly, like Athaliah before him, Yehoash conducted a policy of independence from Israel, severing his links to the northern kingdom. The short reign of Athaliah in Judah is indeed a story of taboo and transgression, but not only because it is the story of a woman and a foreigner taking the throne of Jerusalem. The rise and fall of Athaliah is also a manifestation of the political powers of the region that have shaped the history of Judah in the 9th century BCE. The Omrites, the Davidites, the newly founded house of Yehu, and of course, Hazael, king of Damascus. The taboo being transgressed with Athaliah's reign was that of Israel hegemony over Judah. The expansion of Judah was the result of gradual growth and resistance to Israel, which culminated in the political instability in Jerusalem itself. Thank you.